Thanks for listening to the Best of Outkick the Coverage podcast. Be sure to catch us live every weekday morning from 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern, 3 to 6 a.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio. Find your local station for Outkick the Coverage at foxsportsradio.com or stream us live every morning on the iHeartRadio app by searching FSR.
This is the Best of Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis on Fox Sports Radio.
The Last Dance episodes 9 and 10 officially ended on Sunday night. And so we now have spent, I feel like we need to put all this together and maybe we could do one of these, like a special montage where we discuss all 10 of the Last Dances and have an open from the last five Monday shows as we have been reacting to these episodes. There was not necessarily the earth-shattering revelations here. Although, I would say, we'll get to the Jordan flu game, which doesn't necessarily have the same ring when it's the Jordan food poisoning game. But to me, this was what we've been building for throughout. And I didn't enjoy as much the 1998 championship as I did the overall meandering to get here. And we're going to get into this a lot, I would imagine, before all is said and done. But ultimately, I think Michael Jordan won his seventh championship last night. That's even more the case if the NBA doesn't come back. And let me explain what I mean by that. Jordan, clearly at the end of this documentary last night, was making it very evident that he didn't want to end. I felt like we could have won seven, he said. It was maddening to leave at the peak. And I think you kind of knew it was maddening to him to leave at the peak because he came back and he played with the Wizards, which they didn't even mention as if it didn't happen at all. And for Jordan, that final shot on Brian Russell, even the way he called it BS on the push-off, said he didn't push off at all. They had the great Bob Costas line. But the way he posed, and I loved the zooming in on all of the different reactions in the crowd. And there was that one Bulls fan kid in the crowd and everybody else. And Dennis Rodman said what everybody in that entire arena knew and everybody watching at home knew. And by the way, that's still the most watched basketball game in the history of basketball. You want to think about how wild that is. Never in the history of basketball have more people watched a single game of basketball than game six of the Chicago Bulls against the Utah Jazz. The most watched, since James Naismith invented the game, the most watched game of all time. Jordan brought people into the sport that otherwise were not even basketball fans. And that ultimately, to me, is that moment of him posing as he drained that jumper. There were so many iconic and legendary moments in Michael Jordan's career, but to finish it that way, with that being the final shot that he ever attempted for the Chicago Bulls, is the ending that you probably couldn't have written any better than the way it all finished. And so for Jordan to go off riding into the sunset, at least as a Chicago Bull with six titles in 8 years, and to still feel as if it were maddening to have left then and there, I don't know. The one thing I will say about Michael Jordan's era is I think there would have been so much pressure on Jerry Reinsdorf and Jerry Krause and everybody else that I'm not sure they would have let the Bulls end without being beaten on the court. And so if the NBA doesn't come back this year, and I think the NBA should come back this year, and I think the NBA will come back this year. But if it doesn't, I want you to think about the way that you and your kids and many other people will think about the coronavirus quarantine era 20 years from now. I think you're going to believe and inextricably have connected in your mind this Michael Jordan run in your mind as a big part of what you remember about the coronavirus. And let me explain the way our minds work. We remember everything much better than it actually was. Think about vacations. If you are a parent, there are many vacations you finish and you're like, I want to wring these kids' necks. 10 years later, you go back and you look at some of the pictures or on Facebook or, you know, like you get that memory thing that comes up. And the next thing you know, you're sitting there and you got tears rolling down your eyes. And you're like, you know what? That was the greatest thing ever. Why? How did I not realize that that was the best moments of my life? As humans, and I don't know exactly why it is, even times that are fraught with difficulty and peril and awfulness, very often we remember them in a happier light. And I'm telling you right now, sports fans, if we could put this into the vault and bring it back up 20 years from now, long after the coronavirus is over, long after all of this has passed, I think a lot of us are going to remember watching this documentary with our kids or with our dad or with our grandpa or grandma or mom or whoever it was, all in your houses, all not able to leave really very much. And you're going to be like, man, I kind of remember that as being a lot of fun. And some of you right now are listening to me and you're like, you are crazy, Clay Travis. I am never going to remember anything that has happened for the last 2 months where sports hasn't been going on, and props to NASCAR and golf for coming back. But I'm telling you that 20 years from now, you are going to remember this Michael Jordan documentary and the people that you watched it with, and you will be, you will have a golden-hued recollection of this entire process, and it'll feel like Michael Jordan won another title. My mom used to say, whenever my sister and I were home for summer break, or Christmas, or Thanksgiving, or whatever it was, after you leave, but before you have a family of your own, really, that the best feeling a mom can have is having all of her kids, however many there might be, back in the house after they're adults. It's late at night, you're in bed, and you know everybody's 100% safe. And I think that this Michael Jordan documentary, for a lot of parents, I think there's a lot of you out there listening right now, you're a little bit older than me. You got older kids back home. Kids you don't have, some of your kids are back home with your grandkids. You know, let's say you're in New York City. I was reading an article. Everybody flees New York City because of all the death and destruction going on in New York. Where'd a lot of those people go? Back to grandma and grandpa's house. Back to mom and dad with the grandkids. I think a lot of you collectively, families, have watched this documentary because everybody is starving for sports and everybody's starving for new content. Wife and I, Saturday night, we sat around and watched Extraction. Watched more kids' movies than you could possibly imagine during the last 2 months with our boys. I feel like I've seen everything. I don't know. I've seen every episode in my house, ever they have, at least a Fuller House. And I think a lot of people are going to remember the quarantine as basically Michael Jordan's seventh championship. And I know the debate is going to go on because that's what we do in sports. We debate ad infinitum about who is the greatest at whatever sport it is. And we uniquely, I think, live in a time of greatness because I can argue with you that Usain Bolt is the greatest sprinter of all time. I can argue with you pretty legitimately, I believe, that Michael Phelps is the greatest swimmer of all time. strong argument that Roger Federer is the greatest men's tennis player of all time. Serena Williams, greatest women's tennis player of all time. Tom Brady, probably the greatest football player of all time, unless you want to put him in a different category and just say greatest quarterback of all time. We can run through a lot of greatest of all times. Boom, boom, boom. I just gave you five. Jordan, I believe, is the greatest of all time in basketball. And I don't think, I think LeBron would have to acknowledge, and I think LeBron basically acknowledged it. He's tried to argue otherwise. But I think LeBron basically acknowledged that he was never going to be Jordan when he decided to start to emulate Muhammad Ali. That he was never going to be able to rise up and reach the legendary level of Michael Jordan. And what I believe is become readily apparent is even a lot of people who are LeBron James stans, there's a tiny percentage of the basketball population right now that argues that LeBron is a greater player than Michael Jordan. And that number has diminished substantially based on this documentary. The Jordan brand, David Falk said this on Colin Cowherd's show, the Jordan brand outsells every current NBA player 2-1. And that's because Michael Jordan stands for excellence. And ultimately, when you left this documentary, 90% of you, according to a recent poll we did on my Twitter account, 50,000 of you voted, 90% of you like Michael Jordan more after this documentary than you did before. And I think the reason why we like Michael Jordan more is because we understand him. He's driven by a competitive nature that is rare. But if you look at Michael Jordan, you know what to expect. We don't like hypocrites in society, period. And much of hypocrisy is rooted in inauthenticity. And I will claim to you all the time, I think that's why I work on radio, is because I think almost all of you out there, you may not agree with me all the time, but you understand that I'm telling you exactly what I think. And that's rare, because most people try to tell you what they think you want to hear. And I feel like Jordan authentically tells us what he is, you know, like what is motivating him. And the answer is almost always somebody gave him a slight. Karl Malone won the MVP one year. Clyde Drexler won the MVP. George Karl didn't say hi to him at the restaurant. Brian Russell, of all things, said, "Why'd you quit? I could have defended you." The poor bastard had no idea what he was walking into. That he was going to be forever memorialized by Michael Jordan to finish his shot and to finish his career. And I thought that Jordan uniquely, you know, there was that shot of him with Leonardo DiCaprio, and this guy is truly larger than life. But to me, I thought what was maybe the most compelling moment of this documentary was Michael Jordan's relationship with the older security guards, in particular the security guard named Gus, who became a father figure for him. I want you to think about that for a minute. Think about who most people's entourage is. Young, good-looking athletes. Who are they mostly surrounded by? Other people like them. Right? When you really get used to what a young entourage is, whether you're Leonardo DiCaprio and you're in Hollywood, whether you're Dennis Rodman, we're going to get into the WCW thing, which is just amazing in a little bit. But most people's entourage is people who are somewhat like them, but just not as good, right? Usually your entourage is your yes men, your guys who are like, think about who Jordan's entourage was. Security guards. The guy with the perm. Those guys don't look like real security guards. I mean, in the context of like big, bulky, You know, when you think of most times about security guard, you think about somebody who's, you know, looks like The Rock, right? Like big professional wrestler-sized dudes who look like they could pick somebody up and just throw them through a window if they needed to. Jordan wanted those security guards to be around him. And those were the guys that he liked to chill with. Why was that? What does that say about Michael Jordan's psychology? To me, what it says is he's not worried about what other people think of him. He's comfortable in his own skin. Because most of the time when you psychoanalyze an entourage is about lifting up and making the person who has the entourage look bigger and more powerful and cooler than they already are. Jordan was so comfortable in his own skin that he wanted to spend time with that group of security guards. And that moment where the security guard, Gus's wife, said he got the call. In the middle of the night, Jordan would call him crying about his dad. And that was, to me, just such an unbelievably compelling moment of this documentary. And I couldn't stop thinking as I was watching and as I was taking notes about some of those shots of Jordan choosing to spend time with the security guards. And we had some fun talking about the guy with the perm who recently died in January. But those guys, the guy he played quarters with, those guys to me said as much about Michael Jordan and his persona as so many of these other interviews with more famous people did. And I couldn't stop thinking about that as a way to define Michael Jordan. When we come back out of that break, I just want you to think about it. I want you to think about the last time you saw somebody with an entourage like the entourage that Jordan had. We come back, we'll talk about an entirely different type of entourage. Dennis Rodman, craziness, disappearing to go to WCW. What about the food poisoning game? And how does that change our expectation and understanding of Michael Jordan? All of that we will dive into.
This is Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis.
I hope all of you are having a fantastic Monday. We are discussing The Last Dance, which is obviously the documentary we've been discussing every Monday all quarantine long, as we now completed episodes 9 and 10 of that documentary. And it was an exhilarating, awesome ride. I thought a thoroughly amazing and impactful overall documentary. And it left me wondering, one of the criticisms that's been out there, and I don't think it's really a fair criticism, has been, and you saw this from Ken Burns, oh, Michael Jordan is, it's not really a documentary. And I would push back a little bit on that, because I think what they've done here is create a almost whole new concept. It is almost an autobiography via documentary. And let me explain what I mean by that. Jordan, like, if you're a famous person, most famous people at some point in time write their autobiography. And when they write that autobiography, if you're a writer, you might do it by yourself. But if you're not a professional writer, most people have a ghostwriter or have somebody that they have help them with the writing process. I've written 3 full books, and I wrote every word myself. Now, I have an editor, and everybody who writes a book works with an editor, but I would be offended if you told me, hey, Clay, we want to pay you to write a book, but somebody has to write it with you. Like, no, I'm a writer. That's how I got into radio. That's how I got into television. You sit me down in front of a computer, and you say, give me 1,000 words on X, I can crank out a pretty fantastic column, right? 800,000 words, whatever it is. So if you told me that I had to have help in order to do an autobiography, I would be like, no way, I'm writing every word myself. But if you told me, hey, Clay, we love your story and we want to turn your story into a video, a documentary, well, I wouldn't have any clue how to do that. I don't know how to work a camera. I don't know how to cut and splice. I don't know how to get highlights. I don't know how to go back and even listen to old shows and splice them all together. I'm a tech neophyte. But that's effectively what Michael Jordan just had. And I got to be honest with you. I think it's a really awesome idea going forward. Now, I don't think there are that many people that would be interesting enough to have a 10-part autobiography. But I kind of think right now, and I don't know if you guys agree with me, I'd like to see a camera crew follow Tom Brady and the Tampa Bay Buccaneers this year. I would have actually liked to have seen it last year with the New England Patriots. But this might be Brady's last ride. I think it would be really cool if Tom Brady had a camera crew follow him around and he said, none of this footage will be revealed for 20 years. In other words, I think if the precedent from Jordan and this documentary was created, I think it's an absolutely stellar idea for athletes to do. Because they had this idea 20 plus years ago with this footage to create a story, and Jordan okayed it back then, but he didn't want the documentary to come out until now. And there's almost a precedent with public figures. You know, a lot of people will say, I'm going to give all my papers to X unit my drafts so that people can study it in the years ahead. But then they say, but it's important, you need to know, I don't necessarily want that coming out until after I'm dead or till 50 years later after my death or whatever it is. And there's actually a big discussion about this right now because Joe Biden donated all of his papers. I think it was the University of Delaware because he thought his political career was over. And now there are scandals surrounding Joe Biden. And he's like, well, wait. I don't want my papers to be examined because there might be embarrassing things in there. And I can understand that argument. You know, arguably when you're a public figure, it's different standards, certainly when you're running for president. But when I sit around and I look and I think about really seismic sports figures, I kind of love this idea. Right? If Serena Williams and Tom Brady and Roger Federer and, I don't know, Michael Phelps, people that we acknowledge may well be the best in their sport, if they wanted to give all access to a camera crew near the ends of their careers, but they said, I don't want anything to be shared from this for 20 years, I think that would be really cool. And I wonder whether this Jordan documentary could be setting a precedent going forward. Now, I don't think it would work for anybody but people who would aspire to be the greatest of all time. But I bet you LeBron James and his crew are watching this and they're thinking, oh, next year, if we come back, we need all access cameras so 20 years from now we can tell this story. Hell, I'll tell you this. I would say if the NBA decides to come back, and I think they should, that it would be a really good precedent for Adam Silver to say, hey, we're going to take all access footage of the NBA playoffs this year in the coronavirus. Maybe it's challenging because you don't want the camera guys around, so that's its own test. It's a little bit different. But by and large, wouldn't you find it fascinating to watch a team with an athlete like LeBron or an athlete like Tom Brady or a single sport athlete like Serena Williams, Roger Federer, Michael Phelps, Usain Bolt before he retired, somebody that we think is either the greatest of all time in their sport or would aspire to be considered the greatest of all time. Wouldn't you like to see that footage for them? I really would. And I don't have any problem with the documentary-related aspects of this, but I wonder on some level whether this is going to set, the success of this documentary is going to set a new precedent in the years ahead where a lot of people take a step back and say, you know what? We need to do a version of this too. I don't know that you need to wait 20 years, but I think the longer you wait, the more anticipation you build if the athlete is of the Michael Jordan level. And I also don't think you can underrate the nostalgia impact. On my drive back from Florida, we listened a lot to the Spotify playlist of the 1990s, mostly music that was used in The Last Dance. And a huge part of my enjoyment of this documentary overall has been it taking me back into the past, into my youth, into the 1990s. But think about what it would be like if Tiger Woods had had an all-access camera crew following him for getting the Masters win last year. Think about what it would be like if Tiger had a crew follow him this November all-access, or even if Augusta did it in general. If they had a behind-the-scenes all-access to the fall Masters at Augusta this year, and they released that footage after most of these athletes are all gone in terms of playing. Tell me that wouldn't be something that you would think was incredible. We've got Tiger and Phil coming up soon, and we're going to see a kind of a window into their rivalry. But tell me that Tiger and Phil all access at the fall Masters, talking about their entire careers, or just Tiger Woods, who had aspired to be the greatest golfer ever, sitting down and doing a 10-part documentary. I mean, would you not watch the rise and fall and rise again of Tiger Woods? If he really sat down and answered every question, but he said, this thing's not going to come out for 20 years until my kids are grown, until they have lives of their own. I'll let you talk to Elon. We'll tell you what actually happened. I'll get into every scandal related to my career, but I don't want my kids to be able to see it until they're fully grown, and then I want there to be an honest portrayal of my entire career. And I'm going to let a camera crew follow me Last Dance style as I go through this year's Masters, this year's U.S. Open. And I know there might be some social distancing aspects or whatever. Test all the crews. You telling me that wouldn't be incredible? And that wouldn't be watched by huge numbers of people as you followed Tiger Woods and he talked about his entire career? I really think Jordan, with the success of The Last Dance, may have created an entire new cottage industry. I want you to just think about it. I guarantee you LeBron wants to do it. Tiger, Tom Brady, Serena, Federer. Everybody who is the quote-unquote GOAT, instead of writing a book, wouldn't you like to see them on video basically do what Jordan did and deconstruct their entire careers? I would. I would love it. I hope The Last Dance is setting new precedents for athletes. It's not really a documentary. It's a video autobiography, and I loved every minute of it. All right, when we come back, as much as I love The Last Dance, I think there's a lot of stupidity out there. In the world of sports right now, there's a lot of positive data about the coronavirus. Unfortunately, there's also a lot of dumb people not able to analyze that data. I'll tell you what you need to know and why Major League Baseball, the NBA, MLS, and NHL all should be back sooner rather than later. That's next.
This is Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis.
We've been talking about The Last Dance, Jordan and LeBron, the final episode 9 and 10 of this documentary about the Bulls and the 1990s and how absolutely incredible it was to be able to watch and enjoy. But I wanted to close out saying, again, Major League Baseball needs to be back. And I think the players are in danger in 2020 of making the same mistake that the players did in 1994. Baseball perpetually has an issue with getting a lot of attention from the media. And one reason is because baseball is a great local sport, not a great national sport. And the analogy for why I would say that is Mike Trout can go out, best player in baseball, can go out, make an error in the field, go 0-for-4 at the plate, and not look like the best player in the game. If Michael Jordan or LeBron James play a basketball game, they're not going to have a total failure out there on the field or on the court like you could see from Mike Trout. And even the same thing is true. The best quarterbacks, by and large, don't go out and suddenly perform poorly. So there's so many different opportunities. Even the best baseball player in the world can be humbled by the game in a way that Patrick Mahomes and LeBron James aren't. And in a way, typically, that the best golfer in the world is not typically going to be humbled. He's not going to usually shoot, you know, 10 over par. Can happen, but it's pretty rare for the best golfer in the world. Baseball right now, I just ran through why I think it's a great sport that socially distances pretty naturally. It had an opportunity to be the first sport back. It really did. I think if they had been smart and they had been aggressive, they could already be team sport. They could already be down doing spring training. There's zero. I was just in Florida for 2 weeks. I'm going back down there this weekend. I don't know about Arizona in particular, but the governor of Arizona has welcomed in sports. They could have easily made the decision to be back in baseball. They could be working on spring training right now. They could be ready to go June 1 playing in their home stadiums without fans present and being able to play a lot of games. Instead, they are dilly-dallying. They are arguing. The data is out there. It seems eminently fair to me that the Major League Baseball owners have said, look, we don't know how much revenue we're going to get. We don't know what might happen this season, but we will split it with you right down the middle. We're going to still lose a ton of money as owners, but we want to be able to play the sport. We want to be able to not give the Heisman effectively to all of our fans out there. We want to get baseball back. And instead, it seems like there's a lot of angst and there's a lot of argument, and it's not being rooted very much in the data. I think I could put my lawyer hat on. I think I could sit with a representative from the Major League Baseball owners. I think I could sit with a representative from the Major League Baseball Players Association. And I think in a day, you give me 8 hours, I think I could get this thing hammered out. And baseball players could be back in spring training tomorrow. I don't think it's that complicated if you're looking out for the best interest of the game. And the best interest of the game by far is for these guys to be back. Look, this is crazy. There are going to be little leagues back playing before Major League Baseball is back. Think about that for a minute. I don't know what part of the country you're in, but little leagues are starting to talk about coming back. My little league was almost ready to come back. And then they decided, you know what, we're not going to be able to get all the games in. We're just going to go ahead and close it out because we usually finish by the end of May in Nashville where I play. But I just got notice that our summer basketball league is back on. We're letting Little League basketball and Little League baseball get back before the major leagues and before the NBA can. How is that possible? Everybody out there knows that if you have kids, the thing that you care about the most is the health of your kids. Leagues are being able to play with kids, and Major League Baseball and the NBA can't get things worked out. Doesn't make any sense to me at all. Major League Baseball in particular is blowing it.
Be sure to catch live editions of Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis weekdays at 6 a.m. Eastern, 3 a.m. Pacific.
All right. So forever, and we even talked about this last week, we've talked about the Jordan flu game. And the expectation was that in Game 5 of the 1997 NBA Finals, the Jazz and the Bulls are tied up at 2 games apiece. And Jordan in Game 5 is overcome with sickness. He can barely even manage to hold himself up. All of us who watched those games take place know exactly what I'm talking about in terms of how popular they were and also just in terms of what it did to burnish Michael Jordan's legacy. Well, Jordan said pretty straightforwardly in this documentary, it wasn't the flu game. I was food poisoned. And even that, not having been really out there in a big way. I know that Jordan's trainer had told that story, but I don't remember Jordan telling the story and saying, hey, by the way, it was food poisoning, not the flu. And certainly if you listen to some of the audio clips that they played during the course of that game, the expectation was that it was the flu. That was the way they talked about it. But I thought it was really to me, raises so many more interesting questions. Because, first of all, you hear five guys deliver one pizza. And that's weird. And it makes me think, if I'm an athlete, I never want to eat any food that is prepared specifically for me, especially in the opposing town. But who are these pizza guys? And what did they put on the pizza that made Michael Jordan that sick, such that 24 hours later, basically, 20 hours later, whatever the heck it is, he's still that sick? I mean, I want to know those guys' stories, but also I'm a little bit scared and fearful for Jordan, because you're talking about one of the best athletes ever, and he's made that sick by what they put on that pizza? What food poisoned him and made him so desperately ill? And how close, theoretically, did they come to potentially winning the series for the Utah Jazz? Because if the Bulls had lost Game 5, who knows what would have happened in that series? It's a pretty wild storyline that Jordan never talked about it, and that whoever those Utah Jazz fans were never talked about it either. Because you know those guys were probably, I'm guessing, if they're delivering pizza, relatively young guys, huge Jordan fans, and Jordan eats the entire pizza by himself. Well, who was advising Jordan on that? Now, there's been other rumors, right? The rumor is, oh, he was hungover. That just doesn't fly with me, right? There's some people out there who want to say, oh, it wasn't the flu. Jordan was just hungover. Jordan, to me, was way too competitive. Way too competitive to drink that much that he would be that sick for a game that massive. That, to me, you could just toss that idea out the window. I guess it's possible that it was a coincidence and he ate the pizza and then he got some sort of bug and got sick and he just thought it was the pizza. But definitely, if you add all the little details up, the fact that five guys deliver one pizza, that it's game five, that he's on the road, all of that seems like it adds up to it's now a food poisoning game as opposed to the flu game. He still went for 38, which was pretty outstanding. But that is an interesting part of this legacy. But ultimately, what that game personifies was something that I thought was summed up very well by, I believe it was David Aldridge. And what we don't talk enough about is Jordan's mental toughness. He was mentally tough coming off the food poisoning, whatever you want to call it. But the mental toughness came from a fearlessness that I think David Aldridge said Jordan lived in the moment better than almost anyone. And I feel like that's good advice for everyone out there right now as we deal with challenges in our own lives. So much of the time we spend thinking about either what's past or what's coming, and very little time focused on what we can control in the minute. And that almost sounds very Phil Jackson, right? Because if you think about the stress that Jordan and the Bulls were under, it dwarfs the stress in terms of the amount of attention, I should say. Stress can be different, right? And it impacts people in different ways. But most people fear failure more than they crave success. It's what I've found in my life. And what I have found to be incredibly invaluable across all different facets of life is success often comes when you don't fear failure. And there's a huge percentage of people out there that are afraid all the time. And I'm not necessarily talking about physical failure, physical fear, right? Sometimes physical fear can be healthy. I'm talking about mental fear. Oh, what happens if I try something and I fail? There's a lot of people out there who so fear failure that they don't actually embrace success. And I would say that's one of the most valuable lessons that I've had to learn in my career is failing's okay. There's nothing wrong with failing. You should fail a lot in your life. Because if you don't fail a lot in your life, it means you're really not trying very much. And you're really not pushing yourself. And to me, I thought that was so well said by David Aldridge as one of the interviews, that Jordan had so much success in his career because in a time when lots of people tighten up, when they fear what happens if they miss that shot, when they're worried about what happens if they lose that game, Jordan was so in the moment that he was not focused on what had just happened or what might happen down the line, but what was happening right then and there. And that allowed him to excel. And that allowed him to be confident enough, but also calm enough in crucible moments when you have to win games. And I really kind of focused myself on this documentary, thinking about the psychology of what made Michael Jordan such an incredible winner. And ultimately, it's fearlessness. It's what often makes so many people succeed when other people fail. It's that in that moment, you are so innately in the moment that you're not worried about what people are going to say before or after. Motivation's different. Jordan could find motivation anywhere. But once the game actually began, he was so maniacally focused in the moment that when he rose up to take a shot, he expected it to go in. But even better than that, he didn't worry about what would happen if it didn't go in. How rare is that? Incredible documentary. I've absolutely loved it. We'll talk some about LeBron and Jordan. Put a button on this discussion next segment to finish off the show. I appreciate all of you.